tonight I wanted to talk about breathing as a way of talking about concentration. Once a month we have a, first Monday of the month, we have a study class. Some of you were there the last time, and we've been studying a text by Dogen, who is the founder of the Soto School, on Zazen. And I always point out, because people miss it, that he doesn't discuss breathing at all in the text. And it's really interesting because in America, the way meditation is typically taught, they teach concentrating on the breath is kind of a central practice. They certainly do it in Zen. But here's Dogen, who is conveying a transmitted instruction of how to meditate with no mention of the breath. So it's very striking. And so it's important to notice that the kind of meditation that he's talking about in this text is not actually a practice of concentration, it's a direct practice of awakening. So a long time ago, I realized that Zen is not the only game in town. And even though 40 years ago, when I first started practicing Buddhism in America, Zen was kind of the only game in town, now we have many traditions. And in particular, we have the many traditions of Tibetan Buddhism. And many of the meditations explained in Tibetan Buddhism are very, very similar to Zen. So my conclusion is it's all one stream of teaching. And one thing that's really nice about the Tibetan tradition is they really explain things and spell things out. It's a much more Indian style of teaching than Zen, which is very much more Chinese. So the Tibetans clearly explain the difference between concentration practice and awakening practice and the relationship between them. So using the breath as the focus of awareness in meditation is part of training the mind to focus. The mind is, the non-meditator's mind is very distracted, like a monkey, says most of the Buddhist texts. And in fact, Suzuki Roshi used the word monkey mind as a kind of technical American term. He talked about monkey mind. There actually is, in the Tibetan tradition, a visual teaching of the nine stages of concentration, which stars the monkey and the elephant. The monkey and the elephant. And the elephant represents concentration, and the monkey represents distraction. And it's really interesting. You know, that most people weren't literate in the old days, so they taught through visuals. I won't go into it. Maybe sometime I'll bring the visual and we can go through it. But it's very interesting. The monkey is always jumping around, getting distracted, sees fruit in the tree and jumps off and eats it. The elephant's just kind of walking along. And at the end of the story, the ninth stage, the monkey is just sitting quietly on the elephant's back, and both of them are just very happy and calm. And that's kind of the process of training the mind. So the essential relationship between concentration and insight is that without a focused mind, a mind that can stay focused on one thing for an extended period of time, it's very hard to see how things really are. So you need concentration to develop insight, but it's also true that insight encourages concentration. There is a reason why all of you came to practice, and we would say it's, you know, technically it's your nature as Buddha. Some, or we also use the term bodhicitta, which means the aspiration to awakening. There was some point in each, in your life, each one of you, where the idea of awakening or enlightenment or insight or a different way to live occurred to you, and you, it became a kind of a searchlight in your life. This is universally true for everybody who practices. That's why we have the tradition here and in many other Zen places of way-seeking mind talks. Each person gets to tell their story about how they came to practice, and most of the regulars here have done that, and it is really striking how similar. Everybody has their own story, but the essentials are very similar. So there is a innate sense of wisdom that brings you to the cushion and keeps you there, the chair. So concentration is nourished by awakening even before you know how to concentrate. So there are actually many objects of concentration that are taught in Buddhism, and the Tibetan tradition has preserved all of them. There are 21, whereas in Zen, which is much more of a stripped down essential practice, they mostly use the breath. And if you read the teachings of Suzuki Roshi in one of his three books, particularly Not Always So, Not Always So is the most practice-oriented of the books, even more so than Zen Line Beginner's Mind. Most of those talks in Not Always So were given during Sesshin, so they were very explicitly instructions in meditation. So he talks about breathing and concentrating on the breath a lot. But there's two reasons why the breath is really the best object of concentration. One is it's very physical. So when you concentrate on the breath, you're joining the mental and physical aspects of yourself. The mind and the body are drawn together and harmonize. And the hallmark of distraction is disharmony between the mental world and the physical world. You know, we have colloquial phrases like spaced out. Spaced out, you know, means you're in some mental space and you're not really conscious of your body. If you see somebody sitting, if you walk around in a meditation hall and see somebody sitting, and they're sitting like this, well, they're spaced out. Mm-hmm. So the combination of the posture, the transmitted posture, which Dogen does talk about in great detail, the posture of a straight back and an alignment of the chin, and your head isn't too high and too low, it isn't leaning one way or the other, the eyes are somewhat open. Just practicing with open eyes, which is a style both in Zen and Mahamudra Dzogchen, is very harmonizing, because not only is the mind connected with the body, it's connected with the senses. The eyes, for human beings, the eyes are the most important sense, and there's more, a big part of the human brain is devoted to seeing, because fundamentally we're monkeys that swing from trees, and so we have stereoscopic vision, and we also have evolved to be able to look out over the savanna and see lions coming. So we have a lot of equipment to see things. If we were dogs, it's smell, you know, and other animals, like maybe horses, it's hearing, or cats maybe hearing. But so keeping the eyes open grounds your meditation in the sensory world, which is one of the important hallmarks of our style of meditation. So you're not leaving the sensory world to go somewhere else, you're in the sense world. And by keeping your eyes open, it keeps all the other senses open too, so we're receptive to the senses. And the other quality of the breath that makes it very good for a concentration is the breath is on the cusp of being conscious and being automated. It's both. You'll breathe regardless of whether you're paying attention or whether you're asleep or awake, you will breathe. But you can also consciously manipulate your breath and breathe the way you want to, as they do in pranayama or yoga. So we don't, in Zen, we don't do anything with the breath, but the breath is made conscious. And one of the problems beginning meditators have is that they start to be aware of the breath and they start to change it or control it, and they start to get out of breath and various things happen. You want to just let the breath do its work. The breath knows how to do its job, believe me. but just to so we use the phrase, we watch the breath or attend to the breath. We observe it, but we don't try to change it in any way. When you and attending to the breath is not a beginner's practice. It may seem, particularly because Dogen doesn't mention it, as though you graduate from kindergarten out of the breath and then you don't need it anymore. Actually, an experienced or mature Zen practitioner always has a sense of breathing. Breathing becomes just a part of your life. You know where your breathing is wherever you go, and that's because of all the hours you've spent sitting still and feeling your breath go up and down. But when you bring the monkey mind to the breath, the monkey doesn't like it. The monkey much prefers its own habituated patterns of thinking. So the experience of focusing the mind on the breath induces, actually, it increases distracted thinking. You may think that when you're sitting and your mind is very distracted, that your zazen is terrible. Actually, that's not true. If you have an awareness of a lot of distraction, that's a sign of concentration, actually. So you should be happy about that, that you can see clearly how distracted your mind is. And that's the natural function of the mind. The mind is a thinking organ, and its job is to think. Just like the job of the eye is to see, the job of the mind is to think. And in Buddhism, the mind is the thinking mind is considered a sense organ, just like the ears or the eyes. It does its job, which is to think. But when you yoke the mind, and yoke is the English form of the word yoga, it's the same word. When you yoke the mind to the breath, like yoking wild horses to a harness in a wagon, the mind is taken out of its customary patterns and it resists. The first insight, the first awakening or insight you have when you try to concentrate is that you can see clearly how habituated and how difficult to control our patterns of thinking are. And so it's important not to fight that. And whether or not you're calm or distracted is not a function of how long you've been sitting. It's a function of what's going on in your life, actually. So sometimes people who've been sitting a long time go through periods where they're very distracted and they think, oh, I've regressed. I've lost my Zen has gotten very bad, you know. No, their life has just gotten very busy. So if you're dealing with a crisis, if a close friend of yours is ill, if your children are suffering, if you're out of work, if your house just got foreclosed on, when you try to sit still, your mind will be filled with all of that. It doesn't mean anything. It just means those are the conditions of your life. And as I like to say and often say, Zen meditation is not about being calm, it's about being real. Whether you're calm or not depends on exterior conditions. It's sort of like traffic noise. Some nights it's very noisy out there. The traffic is, this is an amazingly quiet space for being on a four-lane thoroughfare, you know. But sometimes the fire engines come, sometimes there seems to be a lot of traffic. So if you say, well, this is terrible, it's a terrible night to do Zazen because there's so much traffic. Well, it has nothing to do with the traffic, you know. You do Zazen, as I say, you accept what the senses bring you. So if it's noisy, then you do Zazen when it's noisy. If it's quiet, you do Zazen when it's quiet. Either way, you sit. And in the same way, if there's a lot of traffic in your mind, you'll hear all the zooming and the sirens of what's going on in your life, and that's good. During the day, you're not concentrated enough to actually hear that distraction, and so you just it leads you around by the nose, and you wonder why you feel so anxious at the end of the day. Well, it's because you haven't had any time to breathe, really. And when you come to sit, all of that traffic discharges into your awareness, and you know, if you sat long enough, it would, you eventually calm down, or not. Sometimes you have a problem that, like somebody's dying that you love, you're never going to be calm with a problem like that. You're just going to be in grief, and so that's the coloration of your Zazen. So the breath is a kind of touchstone for awareness that grounds you in what's real. The breath is real. Even if nothing else that's going on in your awareness is reliably real, the breath is real. You can always trust it. It's like an electrical ground, or like, you know, the earth touching mudra of the Buddha. You don't have, this is a teaching mudra, but you often see Buddha statues where the Buddha is touching the earth, and that's like the grounding your life in your breath. Actually, many of you know the moment in his life when he did that. According to the legend, it's when he was being challenged by Mara, the great deceiver. In the evening before his enlightenment, Mara brought all the last delusions that he could to the Buddha's mind, basically made him kind of psychotic for a while. And eventually the Buddha touched the earth, asking the earth as a being to support him and to give him a baseline. And Mara couldn't stand up to the earth, so Mara fled. So the breath is like that. It's like a rock, and no matter how bad things are, you can always return to the breath as a kind of mother. But we don't need to be too concentrated, just somewhat concentrated. Part of what the Buddha, the Gautama, and successive generations of meditators discovered is you can become entranced by concentration. And you can become so concentrated that you leave the sensory world entirely and you can abide in a kind of blissful state. Many people who've gone to long retreats discover a way to do this, and they think this is it. This is what Buddhism's all about. Well, no, not exactly. The original Buddha, Siddhartha Gautama, became an expert at those kinds of trances early in his spiritual life. And he discovered something very important about them, which is that they were temporary, and that once you came out of them, you're pretty much the same old person. Your life problems are just the same. In fact, they're a little worse, because now you're a little addicted to the experience of trance, and like any other addiction, it can bend your life out of shape. So that's why I say the purpose of meditation is not to be calm, although you may be calm sometimes, and you may be deeply calm sometimes, but to be real. And we don't aspire to be so concentrated that nothing distracting ever happens. We aspire for stability. Stability is sufficient. Stability means that you're able to accept whatever happens while you're sitting. That's all. Real Zazen is a practice of surrender or of acceptance, of calm, of distraction, of terror, of fear, of anger, of whatever comes up. And when you're sitting still, those karmic forces can do no harm. That's why the story of Mara and Buddha is so important, because Mara was trying to destroy the Buddha's spiritual practice. Mara was the enemy of his spiritual practice, but the Buddha had Gautama, Siddhartha. Sometimes I fool around and say we should just call him Sid, you know, for short. Sid Gautama, you know. Siddhartha was stable enough with his ground in the earth that Mara couldn't move him. But the delusions of Mara were very frightening. And sometimes we'll touch our fear and touch frightening things. The world's very frightening. The world, the daily world that you read about, I guess you can't say the newspaper so much anymore, but you read about on Yahoo News, is a frightening place. And your personal life is a frightening place. And we're not coming to the cushion to banish that fear, to escape from that fear. We're coming to the cushion to accept that fear as just the way things are, and be stable enough that we can accept it without being pushed over. So whatever is going on, there's an inhale and there's an exhale, and that will continue until the day you die. And so it's absolutely trustworthy. And in Zen, as Suzuki Roshi teaches, we specifically have a little bit more emphasis on the exhale, because the exhale is the side of surrender. You just let it go into your exhale. Just let it go. And it all comes back, and then you just let it go. And it all comes back, and you just let it go. Looking at it from that point of view, the longer you sit, the more distracted you can allow yourself to be without being destabilized. So advanced meditators can endure a lot of things. One of my favorite meditation instructions is by a Mahamudra teacher, a living teacher named Trangu Rinpoche, who in answer to a question once said, sometimes when you're meditating, you have terrible thoughts. And then he paused and he said, no, I mean really terrible thoughts. he wanted to make you, he didn't, wasn't specific. I think he was talking about himself. But, you know, you start to have forbidden thoughts sometimes, particularly on long retreats. You'll start to imagine, let's say, murdering somebody. And you think, my God, I'm going crazy. You know, I've never had a thought like that. I'm a horrible person for even thinking that, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And then he said, if you have a thought like that, just continue, just keep meditating. It will go away, you know. So that kind of stability gives you power over Mara. That's the kind of stuff that Mara will bring you, you know, really bad stuff, stuff that you can't stand imagining for yourself. And Mara will bring those things and say, you know, you can't, your spiritual practice isn't strong enough for this one. And I've got more where this is coming from, you know. So you got to stop. You know, you can't, you're not a spiritual person. And you say, well, I'm just going to touch my breath and exhale. And please go your merry way, Mr. Mara, but I'm going to continue. Now, that being said, one of the things we're learning in American Dharma is that there are some aspects of our experience, traumas or very bad things that happen, for which meditation is not good medicine. There may be some other kind of medicine, like psychotherapy, or maybe even sometimes, medical treatment. One of the poignant stories that I always remember, you know, George Gershwin was a great musical genius, and he died at 39. And in the year before he died, he became very unpleasant and strange and difficult. This was in the 30s, you know. They didn't have the kind of medical CAT scans and so forth they have now. And his friends got very upset with him, and many friends left him. Well, after he died, they did an autopsy. He had a brain tumor. He died of a brain tumor. And all of that was because of a medical condition. It was not his fault, you know. And I thought, well, that's true most of the time. A lot of the things that people do, even this horrible, you know, boy in Tucson, you know, he is responsible for what he did, but he's also clearly ill. It's coming out more and more how, sick he really was. And nobody, his parents and people at the school and so forth, nobody helped him enough. And of course, then he could just go buy a gun. That's the big difference. I mean, it's one thing to be ill, but we live in a country where you can just go buy a gun. So that's the debate that's going on, but so much of what people think and what people do is just because they're afraid. And one of the main medicines for fear, for the kind of deep fear that comes with being human, is just to sit still and let yourself be afraid and realize there are worse things than being afraid. It's not so bad to be afraid. In fact, being afraid has some benefits. It makes you behave a little bit more, you know. So it's okay to be afraid, and it helps you have compassion for other people who are afraid. One of the practices I do sometimes is I say to myself, I'm just going to look at everybody I meet and remember that they're all afraid. And even people I intensely dislike, I'll just say, well, they're just terrified. I'm not letting them off the hook for what they do, but it does help to realize that a lot of what people do is just a mask for fear. And so one of the qualities that's universally taught for the Bodhisattva is fearlessness, and it's in the Heart Sutra, which we recite often, that when your practice is accomplished, you banish fear. So fearlessness is one of the fruits of, or one of the insights of sitting. So anyway, I'll continue talking about the breath in future times, but I wanted to stop and give time for discussion. We have about 10 minutes for you know, some discussion. If you have any thoughts or contributions, questions.
What came up for me in the discussion was the first thing about being in a trance-like state. And then the state of being checked out. And to me, those two are very two different things. And certainly, you know, I used to drive all my school teachers crazy because that's how I functioned as a kid in school, was I wasn't interested. And I would just daydream.
You were checked out?
I was checked out.
Uh-huh.
And unless it was history or something that I liked. But if it was other things, and I was always a terrible student until I got into college. But the whole deal of our innate mental health, to me, the core of that is what you're talking about as the trance state. And I just wanted to comment that in my mind, or my understanding is, it's like one is completely conscious, just totally, and the other is completely unconscious.
Well, certainly being checked out is the opposite of a Buddhist view of life. But trance has a technical meaning in Buddhism, which is to be focused on one thought to the exclusion of all others. And that's not quite right either. Not checked out, not in a trance, but present for what's actually happening. So that's one of the many meanings of the middle way, which is what the Buddha called his practice, the middle way. You know, so I don't know exactly what you mean by trance, but maybe it's what
I'm going to comment that I would say what I'm talking about is before thought.
Yeah, that's right. I'll get to that maybe in a future lecture. You know, when we sit, one of the things we discover is you don't really need to think all the time. And thoughts subside. I'm very reluctant, most Buddhist teachers are reluctant to say that the goal of meditation is not to think, because then people will try not to think.
Right.
That's very different. But thinking gets tired. The monkey gets tired.
Yeah.
Eventually. The monkey gets tired. The elephant never gets tired, but the monkey gets tired.
Yeah.
And so you want to sit and have enough experience of sitting so that the monkey gets tired. And there's actually pictures in these teachings where the monkey is just sitting there. It's just tired out, you know. It's tried and tried. It's done all its work, you know. It just gets tired. And when the monkey is tired enough, you can sit with an awake mind and not much thinking at all. Not much thinking at all. And it's what Suzuki Roshi called real thinking. This was his term for it, real thinking.
Yeah.
Real thinking is a topic for a future talk. It's fairly technical. But real thinking is like your mental activity exactly matches what's going on. So anyway, now I understand what you mean by trance. awake but not thinking about anything in particular. Yeah. This is what Dogen's talking about in his essays on Zazen, because that state of mind is naturally joyous, and the feeling of it is very deeply satisfying and deeply compassionate, actually. It isn't a neutral feeling tone when you're like that. It feels good, and you feel really connected to other people. Something else? Yeah, Bruce.
Yeah, I was curious. You used the term awakening practice in contrast to concentration practice. And I was wondering if you could expand on the awakening practice.
Well, I was translating the term vipassana,
okay.
Which is... the shamatha and vipassana are the two halves of meditation, and vipassana is most usually translated as insight, but you know the word Buddha means awakened, so I thought I just spontaneously decided to translate it as awakening tonight, because Buddhism is a practice of awakening, not just a practice of insight. Insight is a little small, you know. It, you know, practice includes insights of all kinds, you know, that we have as we practice. But when you put all those insights together and add much more, then you have awakening. Awakening is what Vipassana really leads to. So that's all I meant, you know. I wasn't trying to invent something new. But I also don't like to overuse technical terms. But it sounds like you're familiar with those terms.
Well, yeah, and I was kind of curious because in addition to, you know, the shamatha, vipassana, there's also this sense in, jian, or the, you know, Chinese tradition, of an introduction of both samadhi and prajna working in a sort of synthesis.
Samadhi and prajna are other terms for shamatha and vipassana. They're the same. Balance, a little different,
yeah,
a little
yeah.
different, but the same kind of, yeah, and actually awakening is the synthesis of both. An awakened life includes both. And samadhi becomes, when you're mature in it, it becomes the way you are, not something you enter and leave. It's just the way you are. But it's samadhi with eyes. You see things clearly. But it sounds like you perhaps know of some specific teaching from the Chinese tradition of modern Zen.
Yeah, this was something that was discussed in a book by Red Pine.
Red Pine.
And really very fun travel log, but it relates to an experience that I've been working with in my practice that I just describe as an open focus.
Yeah.
The focus quality that still is absolutely like the soft eyes of Aikido, where you are definite and yet completely sort of open to the unknown. This is sort of my sense of this, you know, samadhi, prajna.
Right, I would agree.
Okay.
Yeah, the soft eyes of martial arts are come from Zen. And that is the way you learn to observe. It's not just a martial arts skill.
Always good for, yeah, good for driving and parking in the city.
Right? It's good for a lot of things. It's what Suzuki Roshi called beginner's mind. In other words, you don't come into a situation with assumptions. You don't have a hard focus, like I know what's going on. You come in with a sense of, like you said, you know, open. Like I have a sense of what might be going on, but I'll wait and see.
Mm-hmm.
And I won't look at any one thing to the exclusion of the others, you know. Usually when we live out of desire, our focus is toward the things that we want.
Mm-hmm.
It's like a dog coming into a room and going immediately to the smelly thing. Comes in, it goes whoop, you know, that's all it's interested in. And so we come into a room and, you know, boop, we're looking at a person that we're attracted to, some food on the table, some money, some powerful person, some opportunity to, you know, something self-centered. That's what we usually do. So that would be the, not be soft focus. That would be, the usual way people are. When you're not, when you don't really have any particular idea of what you want, you come into a situation and actually all you really want is to find out how you can help. You know, that's the Bodhisattva vow. You come into a situation and you're open to an invitation to be useful. And that's what we do. We have maybe time for one or two more quick things, if anybody has a thought.
I've got a question. You were talking about breathing before, where you were saying, so as you're sitting and you come to your in-breath, you kind of flash through your body, get a sense of what's happening.
Well, my colleague Paulden likes to teach that because it's a Mahamudra teaching, but she and I have talked about it, and also Suzuki Roshi taught that too, but it's not on the in-breath, it's on the out-breath. So the rhythm is you breathe in, you breathe out, and as you breathe out, your breath is naturally kind of spreading out as you exhale into your whole body and then into the out there. So as you breathe out, you have a sense, it's not a, she calls it a flash, maybe that's a translation of some Tibetan word. I think I wouldn't call it that, it's because it sounds like some special thing. It's more like, you have a moment where you can just feel your whole body, you know, from the inside. You feel the shape of it. You feel the expanse of it, you know, and that naturally comes at the as you exhale. You exhale, and it's very healing to do that because all of your mental activity is released into the energetics, you know, the energy channels of your body. And it's cleansing, you know, it's like, it's so that's, you know, you inhale, exhale, and you're here, and you inhale. So in Buddhist concentration texts, and also in yoga, there, you know, one came right out of the other, there's a teaching of a three-part breath. That's the three parts. Inhale, exhale, and kind of a pause, in which you just feel your body. There's also a seven-part breath, if you really want to get articulated. Let's not go into it. But, you know, you can get more and more refined about the stages of breathing. And, you know, in Chinese Zen or Japanese Zen, they don't teach the seven-part breath. But as I say, the Tibetans are more Indian style, and there is a breath yoga of the seven-part breath. And it's very, you know, you can... If you really want to yoke your mind to the breath, every stage can be a yoking point, you know, beginning of the inhale, middle of the inhale, top of the inhale, you know, middle of the exhale, end of the exhale, pause. It's seven steps, and each time there's a touch point, the mind goes there, you know. You know, early in my practice, that was back in the 60s when all these books about stuff like this were just coming out, and I tried all that stuff. I tried everything. There's a there's a teaching in Japanese Zen called bamboo breathing, which is a particular kind of belly breathing they also have in the Tibetan tradition. People have been doing this stuff for thousands of years for their whole life, and believe me, they've come up with a lot of teaching, you know. And what's striking about Dogen's brief essays is how succinct they are and how uncomplicated. And that is kind of the Zen style. It's very essential. It's just the most essential points. But around it is all this vast array of technique and experience, which, you know, if it interests you, or if you find it useful, or if your teacher thinks it would be helpful to try, you can delve into, you know. So that's maybe a bigger answer than you were looking for, but, you know, in, out, and full body, in, out, full body. Okay, well, let's do our...